Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's actually quite wonderful to see that there's quite a few community members are traveling or away right now, but yet the hall's still quite full, even just of monks. So it's a kind of nice to see the monastic communities growing, and the lay community, people supporting the monasteries is growing. It's kind of partly in my mind, too, just because we had a building committee meeting today that Ajahn Pasano, myself, and several other people were involved in, and just moving forward with getting a larger space for meditation and communal activities. So that's quite a joy being part of that and seeing that moving forward. Say right now, Ajahn Pasano, tomorrow morning we'll hopefully be leaving to go to Canada for attending a ceremony for the Katina celebration at Tisarana Monastery, and Ajahn Yaniko and Tampamuto are somewhere, we don't know where, wandering on Tudong. I don't think anybody's heard from them, positive or negative, so hopefully we'll see them in about a week. I just returned from about a 10-day trip to the Midwest, and when I first got back, people were just asking, how was the trip, and asking because there are details. But for some odd reason, I was kind of tight-lipped about it and didn't really say much. So I thought maybe tonight just talk a little bit about it, because it was a very good trip for myself anyway. And I was kind of thinking about that today, if I was going to talk about it or what I was going to talk about it. But the trip had several different components to it. When I was in three different states, sort of meeting with, four different groups. And I kind of planned that each of the different groups I'd kind of be talking about different things, just to kind of challenge myself or kind of keep things fresh as well. Couple kind of things overlapped, but it was interesting to me to sort of being in these different situations. They were also kind of vastly different types of groups, and in each of the different places when I was giving talks, just sort of the questions or the focus of the individuals that were in attendance, I really learned a lot about the subjects that I was talking about in these groups. But just even the whole reason for the trip was, I've told this maybe to this group before, but just the 2 years ago, I was traveling from Indiana, coming back to California, and it was just a very chance encounter with the person sitting next to me on the plane, and just taking the opportunity to be kind to him, just sort of reaching out and talking to this person. And he asked me later, when I was on these travels, to tell the story. So I asked him, so I've heard it in my head many times, so I'd like to hear your version of the story. And his version of the story was, he got on the plane and saw that he was going to be sitting next to me. He thought, oh, wow, a Buddhist monk. This is going to be an interesting flight. And he was sort of in the back of his mind, he was sort of wondering, how's he going to strike up a conversation, kind of casually, to sort of bring up conversation with a stranger. And then I was the one that actually sort of broke the uneasiness, and started talking to him, and then that kind of opened it up. But it turns out that he was had been a professor of mine in college, and neither one of us, of course, he didn't recognize me because I didn't look this way 25 years ago, but 27 years ago at this point. But that started a conversation. It turns out he's a professor of psychology at a little university just 25 miles from where my parents live. And then so he had told me if I was ever back in the Midwest to, you know, contact him, and so I did, and ended up spending, you know, over 2 days there at that university, and met with two classes, and then gave two sort of public talks at the university, and they were, you know, especially the public talks were well attended, and lots of really good questions. And my favorite encounter, though, was this university. It was like 25 miles down the road from the university, the college that I went to school at, and they have this huge rivalry in football. And unless you've ever kind of been in kind of a small colleges where they have rivalries like this, you probably wouldn't understand the kind of the intensity of the rivalry. But I think this year they play for the 120th time consecutive games, and they play for this trophy. This huge 350-pound bell that was, I think that, you know, they played each other 120 times, and like the record of the two teams is like 60-60. So it's like, you know, it's very, very competitive. And I went to the rival college of where I was speaking. So every time I had the opportunity, I'd sort of throw in there that I was a graduate of Wabash, and just to see what people's reactions were. One day I decided at the kind of the meal time, I'd already eaten, but I decided to go hang out in the student union, the cafeteria, and just walking through to see if anybody would invite me to sit with them, or, you know, just if anyone was interested in talking. And sure enough, a bunch of freshmen sort of invited me over to their table, and, you know, they were interested in what I was doing. And I'm trying to think how this went. Well, they were just, you know, interested. Well, I guess they sort of came up in the sense of being from Wabash. They were just sort of, you know, they were interested in that I was a Buddhist monk and, you know, what we do. One thing I noticed on this trip was that, let's say, the university I went to, this is grossly over-exaggerated, but it's like there's a strong emphasis on, a lot of the graduates go on to med school or to law school. There's a big emphasis on, you know, sort of like how well you do in your career and making a lot of money, and the rival school, DePaul University, you know, there's that as well. It's a good university. But I did notice with the students there was much more of an emphasis on sort of, you know, like how are they going to help in the world? You know, like their careers weren't so much about making money. It was more about making a name for themselves. But there tended to be a little bit of that sense of, yeah, how can they help in society? So I kind of, you know, took that approach when I was, you know, talking to him about what it's like being a Buddhist monk, or, you know, what we do as in Buddhist practice in general. And then one of the students then asked, you know, "Well, how did you know, why are you here? Like, you know, how did you end up at DePaul?" So I took the opportunity to tell him the story about the professor and how I went to Wabash. And there was this one guy sitting across the table from me, and he visibly, I wouldn't say, not to say got upset, that's not the right phrase, but he, you know, sort of puffed up his chest and backed up and said, you know, and he said, "I was told I'm supposed to hate people from Wabash." And he had, you know, kind of, you know, attitude, and I knew exactly where it was coming from, because I had that same, you know, attitude when I was a freshman, and, well, even probably 4 or 5 years after graduating, I still had that kind of sort of attitude towards DePaul. But I just looked at him, and I said, I had that attitude before, and, you know, but I just see is we have so much more in common than we do, you know, separating us, you know, stuff like that. And he didn't seem to bite. But then the other students were real, still kind of really intrigued and asking lots of questions. And I guess that's when we really got into, well, the first question he asked then, because you have to know this part of the story too, Wabash is an all-male college. And so he immediately challenged me. He says, you know, "What's it like going to an all-male school?" You know, kind of, you know, like that's a negative thing. It was his kind of the way he asked the question. And I just sort of said, "Well," I said, "you know, in some ways I feel like, you know, I did get cheated in my education." It's like, I pointed out, I remember my senior year, I was in some sort of philosophy class, and we were debating some sort of point. And I remember sort of looking around the classroom thinking, you know, this debate would probably be going in a very different direction if there were women involved in this conversation. And I remember, you know, that was, you know, one of the first, but it was a major time when I was like, yeah, it was like, this is a good education, but it's probably not completely 100% rounded. And so when I said this to that student, I could see immediately, then he relaxed. Like, okay, he's not going to be completely defensive of his position, and he's maybe a little more open-minded than most Wabash people are. So he relaxed a little bit. And then other people started asking questions about, you know, meditation or, you know, how our lifestyle works. And yeah, slowly as the conversation was going on, students were kind of realizing that they had to run off to class. And at the very end of the conversation, it was just me and him sitting there. And then we were still talking, and then he goes, oh, and, you know, he looked down at his watch, and, oh, I'm going to be late to class. And so he still hadn't sort of, you know, totally warmed up yet. But then as he was getting up, he kind of reached over and leaned in and stuck his hand out, you know, to shake my hand. And I think he kind of just did it habitually without kind of thinking about it. You know, here he is, you know, someone's supposed to hate people from Wabash, but he's offering me his hand. So I kind of took his hand and leaned into him, and I said, you know, I think it's okay for you as a, you know, as a student to hate, you know, Wabash students. I said, yeah, that's normal. It's a rivalry. But I said, but it's okay to respect the alumni. And then he kind of looked at me and kind of a big grin came across his face, and he goes, I'll think about it. And I was like, okay, that's good enough. And then he departed. So that was kind of like the highlight of that little trip, and then that part of the encounter. But I do think there was something, you know, kind of important in that, you know, to me, that sense of, you know, we do have, you know, way more in common than we have, you know, separating us. Actually, I didn't tell him this, but 1 year shortly after graduating, I was traveling in Nepal, and at that point I was kind of traveling completely on my own, and I remember at a certain point being in Kathmandu and went to this sort of, is a very popular place for Westerners to go for kind of a cafeteria, and I saw somebody walking through, and she had a Nepal University T-shirt on, and I remember the time thinking, you know, like, wow, just a couple of years ago, I would have, you know, thought of her as the quote unquote the enemy, you know, and stuff like that, but here, like in, you know, Kathmandu, it's like she's probably the person in the country right now that I probably have the most in common with, you know, the most in common with, like, you know, she went to, you know, school in Indiana, you know, probably studied the same subjects, you know, probably even know people, you know, the same people and stuff like that. So I think that was sort of the breaking of that sort of barrier, that sort of sense of separation and being us and them. And so that's, I think a big part of the practice is, you know, seeing through the stories that we tell, you know, about ourselves and about other people. So that was the being there in Nepal. It was like one thing that sort of came up for me. Then right after that, I went back to my hometown where I grew up, and there's a yoga studio that's there. And this is I think the second time that I've been there. But a really nice group of people. I was hoping my art professor was going to be there, but he ended up having a board meeting and wasn't able to attend. But I had to give a talk about the artwork that I've been doing and how I use that as meditation. So that's a subject I've talked about several times here. So I did that when I was back at my parents. And then I think my mother and I both kind of inspire each other. So it's like a lot of my painting. And I mean, she was the one that definitely got me started on what I'm doing now by sort of encouraging me about 10 years ago when I was visiting to do some paintings. And then when I was just this back, she was a professional seamstress and just making, you know, so incredibly beautiful sort of like wedding dresses and things like that. But she's sort of setting that down. And she's recently started oil painting. And I was just, you know, totally amazed at the, you know, stuff she's doing. She's just starting to learn. So it was kind of fun the two of us critiquing each other's artwork while that was back at home and watching her do some artwork. So that was just a very, very short visit. I think I only spent like, less than 48 hours back at my parents' house. But a friend of mine in Chicago who's been a nice supporter of by Geary and of myself personally, wanted me to get in touch with one of the professors at Wabash College. It was somebody that he's met through some committees, and he thought the two of us would hit it off. So I really wanted to spend most of the time with my parents, so I just arranged to have a cup of coffee with him for an hour. And turns out he's in the psychology department at Wabash, and turns out that he's originally from Seattle and is totally into coffee. And so he invited me over to his house for just a cup of coffee, and it was kind of funny. It felt like we just sort of sat down and just started talking. Then my dad sort of pulled up to pick me up an hour later, and it just seemed like 1 minute had gone by. And we're like, "Whoa, that was what happened." And then I kind of wrote that to him in an email, and he wrote back and said, "You know, I think if we'd have sat down for 3 hours, I think the same thing would have happened. You know, like it would have gone by in just like a minute." So it was like there's this nice connection there. And so I'm trying to work out with him when I'm probably going to be going back for a little bit longer visit next spring, and I'm going to see if we can do some sort of a joint sort of workshop at the college or something. But he, in the last email we had, we were kind of exchanging information because he was quite interested in sort of Buddhist philosophy, and then I was interested in what he was doing, and he had given me a reference to some of the work he's doing. I was just kind of looking up online and looking forward to sort of challenging myself in reading up on sort of that kind of what's happening in the world, very very closely related to say meditation and understanding of the mind, how the mind works. Then that was a very short visit though back to Crawfordsville, Indiana, and it's interesting, every single time I travel to the Midwest, if I have to make a connection flight someplace, I always try to fly through Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I've always very consciously done that, just with the thought that if there's a delay in the flight or something happens, I know quite a few people in Minneapolis, and there's always been in the back of my mind that if I got stranded there, I'd be able to call somebody. So it was very interesting that when I was flying to North Dakota, my flight got canceled, and I was in Minneapolis, and a friend of mine who's actually going to be here next week was planning to attend the retreat I was going to do in North Dakota, and I called him up when my flight got canceled, and I said, "Hey, John, where are you?" And he's like, "I'm not supposed to be picking you up, am I?" And I was like, no, I just want to know, where are you?" And he said, "I'm at home getting ready to leave for the retreat." And I said, "Well, do you mind stopping by the airport and picking me up?" And so he swung by a half hour later and had a lunch for me. And then we drove the 5 hours to North Dakota instead of flying, and made it there in time for the talks. And so, but that was really fun, to be able to catch up with him and see what he's doing. John traveled over with me to New Zealand when I was there quite a few years ago. And actually took Ajahn Yatiko and myself down to the Grand Canyon with another friend. So he's been also a nice supporter and a good friend of mine. So I got to catch up with him and see how he's doing. Then when we got to North Dakota, that was Kevin Fugelseth's invitation. And so he wanted me to come, and he asked specifically if I would probably do a retreat on loving-kindness meditation. And so I gave a talk Friday night kind of introducing, the way that I practice it. And then basically Saturday was all day kind of giving instructions, and Sunday was just more of a practice day of using those instructions. And several times there were question and answer periods in there that was really good, because it kind of challenged me in the way that I've been teaching it, and just people's questions about it, because it is slightly different than it's normally taught. I'll come back to that in a minute. But then after the retreat was over, then went to Minnesota, and basically that was the first time I had some time to relax. And John and I went out to a cabin that he owns, and got to spend a full day just sort of doing nothing. The next day had a kind of full day kind of at this meditation center in Minneapolis called Common Ground, and gave a talk there, and then the next day flying back here. So it was a very full but rewarding trip. Kind of two thoughts about that right now is that the one is that, well, going back to the retreat, the thing that questions that came up several times that I had to think about it in different ways, or try talking about it in different ways, because you know, when I was saying it, it's like I could tell that people were connecting with what I was saying, but they still had lots of questions. I was like, okay, well, something's not quite there. And then the main point that I found interesting, or what people were finding interesting, was the way that the way I practice is, you know, with doing the four Brahma Viharas and loving kindness in general, is that sense of when you start doing beings other than yourself, that you don't send the loving kindness. And you know, when I mentioned that, I was like, you know, people were sitting with their eyes closed, and you know, about half the people kind of opened their eyes and looked at me like, "Are you sure you said that correct?" You know, but as I started explaining it, you can see, you know, you're watching, people are shaking their head like, "Oh yeah," you're like, "Oh wow, that makes a lot of sense." And so, I've talked about that a lot in this group, the community. But you know, just in general, though, it's like that. I really like that kind of instruction, and the fact that you know, once you've developed the, you know, that sense of loving kindness, and you have that energy, and you're starting to develop some concentration, because say the mind is interested and is getting engaged with it, that if we you know, do get the sense that we're sending that loving kindness to somebody else, it actually, I get a sense that it is depleting the energy. And so that the quality of the effort and the energy that we need to develop the concentration to keep that interest there, that if we're always sending that away, that you know, it takes away from the meditation. And I do get the sense of, at least from my own practice of doing loving kindness, there's always a sense of sort of building up the energy. It feels really good, and then for various reasons it becomes difficult to do loving kindness, then you have to start all over again, and you build it up, and it depletes again. And I think one of the reasons is that sense of sending the loving kindness. So as I was describing all this, I was, you know, watching people, and I could see that, you know, they, you know, from their own experiences, it seemed like that was, you know, they could agree with that. But they kept asking, you know, sort of questions around this, the sending it and not sending it. And the way I described it, finally, one time that it was interesting, it connected deeper with me, was that the way I'm kind of viewing it now is that say, as you're doing the loving kindness, you know, for yourself, and you've developed it, and you've got that sense of an energy, you know, that soft glow kind of feeling that you're kind of, you know, getting absorbed into that energy. And then I always describe it as sort of like, you know, holding a bowl of oil in front of you. So like as you're developing that loving kindness, so you've talking about it is really just an intention, you know, just that intention to not do harm. You know, I think that a lot of times we do have this feeling that loving kindness is the sort of like blissed out, sort of ecstatic feeling. And, you know, that can come from the concentration. It's like if you do get focused in on the meditation and you enjoy that particular type of meditation, the result of concentration is that ecstasy. And then we say one of the reasons that we have to do the meditation, then it can kind of subside, and then we have to build it up again, is because we take the attention away from the what actually caused the loving kindness and focus it on the, say, the blissed out feeling. And so then and then of course the focusing on the bliss isn't what caused the bliss, and then it dies, and then we have to start all over again. So this you're really stressing that, you know, the loving kindness is really just the intention not to do any harm to ourselves primarily and to others. And so just having that attitude in the world of, you know, how can I approach the situation where I'm not going to cause any harm. So like when I was with that student at DePaul, you know, it's like, you know, if I really was still stuck in that mind state of, you know, Wabash is perfect and DePaul's terrible, you know, it's like, you know, who knows where that conversation could have gone. But, you know, it's just like, well, yeah, I didn't want to, I mean, we have way more in common than we do separates us. So why would I want to create, you know, any, you know, antagonism there? You know, it's like, and I think part of my sort of, sort of mentioning to people that I was from Wabash was to actually kind of challenge that a little bit, you know, just let them see that there's, that, you know, it wasn't in any sense of trying to create ill will or hostility, but you know, it's more kind of more playful. So then in those situations, then you can, you know, to create connections, to kind of break down barriers. So with this, you know, was really stressing with loving kindness. It really is, it comes back to the intention. It's like, you know, I could be mentioning to people I was from Wabash in a very aggressive way of trying to make people feel uncomfortable, or do it in a way that is you know, trying to make connections. But then, yeah, with that focus, then that yeah, loving kindness is just this, just the intention, and you know, developing that, and then paying attention to the, you know, just when you do, when you start developing that for yourself, it's just, yeah, not trying to create any tensions, any stress, and just having, you know, goodwill towards ourselves. That if you pay attention to that, there is a happiness that comes from that, because there's, you know, a sense of that self-respect, sense of well, also just, you know, just having the intention and focusing on the intention gets us out of the story as well. We all have stories about ourselves. We all have stories about why maybe we're not worthy of loving kindness, or, you know, just all sorts of obstacles that we create in why we don't have loving kindness towards ourselves. And so just, you know, focusing on just that intention, it can, you know, totally cuts out the story. We do use thoughts, we do use memories, sort of to bring up the, you know, the feeling, or to keep the mind focused on the intention. But then, you know, ultimately, once you really start connecting with it, it is to drop the story. So then, when we start doing it to other people, the image I always give is like when you're developing it for yourself is just, you know, holding that bowl of say oil or something, that's, you know, bowl, it's in front of your heart that you're holding, and it's completely filled to the brim. And if you're not paying attention, if you lose that intention, then you've stopped doing the loving kindness, and you're starting to spill that bowl. So you're just holding it with that pure intention and total focus on that. And as thoughts and memories and things come through, it's not about not thinking or preventing thoughts, but you can still stay with the intention. So as the stories do come up of, you know, why do you think you're worthy of this? Or don't you remember that time when you did something really kind for somebody and nobody appreciated you? It's if you stay with the intention of the loving kindness and just really focusing on that bowl, as that story comes up, you can't actually pick it up. So it's because you're staying with the intention. So you just see the story come and go. And as we learn sort of not to pick up the story, then, you know, that story loses power, because you see that, oh, you don't have to pick it up. You don't have to believe this. The story comes and goes, and we chose not to have any involvement in it. You just sort of learn how to do that over and over and over again until it starts to lose its power. So then, you know, when we start to do loving kindness for other beings, you know, that intention is exactly the same. It's still the exact same intention, not to do any harm, not to have any ill will. And the way I have been describing it is the sense of, like, it's actually inviting, you still have that same sense of loving kindness, still intention not to harm, and you still have, say, that bowl in front of you. But now it's like you're inviting somebody else, bringing somebody else into your consciousness. And so, you know, it's always best to start with someone who it's really easy to do, someone you have a lot of gratitude towards. And so bringing them in and just, you know, having that person there, not having that, you know, and continuing to have that sense of loving kindness towards that person. And you start learning, you know, different aspects of how the story will change. The stories that you tell about that person change, and it might be easier, more difficult to not get hooked into the story. So you just learn from a different perspective. So as I was describing this, and say people could understand that, but then in sort of answering several people's questions, what I kind of discovered, or, you know, what I was thinking about in a new way is that, you know, I kind of think like doing all the different categories, and when we're continuing to doing the loving kindness, it really is sort of like you're always continuing to focus loving kindness on yourself, even though you're doing other beings, including, you know, it's like a, your teacher or your best friend or the neutral person or the difficult person. It's learning really to keep that loving kindness towards yourself, because it's a, that bowl of loving kindness and that, that feeling, it never really changes. And so that was just talking about it in that way was kind of a shift for me. Also, too, when I was describing the practice in general, because this was the first time I'd actually taught it as a complete package of the Brahma Viharas, which is not just loving kindness, but equanimity, joy at other people's good fortune, and compassion. And I think for myself, or I'm going to probably go for the winter retreat, and I've kind of determined I want to kind of pick up loving kindness again as my theme for the meditation for the retreat. We'll see what happens. But one aspect of it that I also see with loving kindness is that it is true that, say, you know, when you're practicing the Brahma Viharas, so at any one given moment, you can really only kind of be in one of those states of mind, say, you know, loving kindness or compassion or joy or equanimity. But I do see that all four of them work together, that they all support each other. And in the way in the Visuddhimagga, it really does kind of stress you start with loving kindness and develop that. And then from that, both compassion and joy arise from sort of that practice. And then, say, equanimity is probably like the most difficult to develop. But I saw the way I'm thinking about it is that equanimity, I think, needs to be focused on a little bit more with that practice. I mean, one thing is also, too, I always think about loving kindness in terms of the peaks and the valleys. You know, it can be blissful and then almost like aversion towards it. A lot of people have aversion towards loving kindness meditation. And I think if the practice really starts with or focusing more on the equanimity practice, I think that will have a much more balancing a quality to it. And say, you know, the instructions that I've been following, you know, recently have actually, you really stresses to start off with just the first quarter of the meditation. Like, so if you know you're going to sit down for, say, 45 minutes or, say, an hour, if you can sit down for an hour, like that first 15 minutes is to develop the equanimity practice. And mainly that's through just the awareness of the breath, doing anapanasati, and you know, just coming back to bringing the mind back to neutrality, just sort of not necessarily trying to, you know, not think, just trying to bring the focus back to, yeah, just to neutrality, to the breath. And the instructions are just to, very, very classic sort of Vipassana meditation instructions, but you know, as you're just noting, so as you're meditating, focusing on the breath, when thoughts do arise, just to note them, what they are, just so the mind won't get hooked into them. So as you're meditating, and all of a sudden you start noticing, say, aversion or craving or just even obsessive thinking, just even note that that's what's happening. So you're thinking, and the whole purpose of it is so the mind won't grab a hold of it. So you clearly know what's happening, and then you can, as soon as you feel like the mind, you know, hasn't grabbed a hold of it, then you return it back to the breath, and you just, you know, do that, you know, over and over again. And you know, when you do that, then the mind does get to a certain, you know, level of, well, any, whatever level you get to of sort of the mind being able to do that, of not hooking in, then when you start to do the focusing on the intention of loving kindness, it's just, you know, it's that much more powerful, for one thing, because the focus is there, the concentration's there, but also there's that equanimity. So it's like when the mind, because it will, if it's conditioned that way, you know, to tell stories or to be judgmental or critical of ourselves, we can approach that with much more equanimity, because you've already been strengthening that. So then, as those stories come up, then it's so much easier not to lose that, you know, the intention of staying with loving kindness. the professor that that I was meeting with, I can't pronounce the person's name, but one of the psychiatrists that psychologists that he had said he was reading about was talking about kind of flow, or sort of like I think of it as sort of like peak experience and sort of the qualities that come up from that. And it was interesting because I've talked a lot about sort of the artwork that I've been doing and the paintings that I do, and it's almost kind of word for, you know, he's got this list of like, say, 10 sort of qualities that come up from when someone's in flow, and it's like, well, that sounds exactly like what I talk about when I'm doing my artwork, which I actually knew that was kind of the process. But one thing he sort of broke out the sort of flow chart or a graph of actually sort of, I forget how you'd phrase this, but a kind of a paradigm of you know how peak experience comes about. And he, on this two sides of a, let's say, an axis, one was one of the qualities is challenges, like so how challenging a project is that you take on or responsibilities you have. So like, you know, it's not challenging at all to it's you know extremely challenging and demanding. And on the other axis is your skill level, so like you have no skills at all, and then or you're extremely skilled in it. This was quite fascinating to me, because I'd never seen this kind of analysis of sort of breaking down. And so, you know, kind of thinking about this in terms of, you know, definitely in terms of like my artwork, I could see that immediately in terms of that, like how interested or when I did get into those periods of time when, say, time ceases to exist and the mind is extremely engaged. You know, it's like, yeah, you're challenging the mind to create something, have a particular image. You did know you had worked over years to develop a skill, and you kind of knew that you could do that. And so that when you were doing that, the mind was interested, and it could get into that kind of, yeah, like this, the flow, peak experience kind of absorption into that. And so kind of interesting now to sort of take that the same kind of, you know, challenge or that same attitude or just a way of evaluating it with any type of meditation or any type of duties that we have. And so and just real quickly, you know, I like the way he's got it down is like he's kind of broken it down into sort of like 8 different sort of mind states that we can be in. And I think all of us probably at various times, even throughout the day, might, you know, find ourselves in various of these kind of mind states. And it's kind of interesting to look at it in terms of like, you know, what's the challenge level that what we're taking on, or what are our skills. And, you know, with these, it's like, you know, the skills, the, you know, we definitely as meditators are always working on, you know, on our skills, learning, memorizing things, or learning to be, you know, more skillful at our meditation, or, you know, dealing with, all of us are always working on our communication skills. And so, you know, that's one of the things that's quite a joy about being a monk, is that there's always these opportunities for learning skills, and just many great examples of people around us doing that as well, you know, in areas that we maybe don't have any interest in at all. But to seeing somebody else challenging themselves in a way is really inspiring. And then we also always have challenges. So it's like, well, just all of us, you know, like we're constantly, our duties are being, you know, switched around and getting challenges that way. Or you might, as the more you get senior, you have to maybe have more interactions with the public, or as you, on Agarika, you might be, you know, challenges of driving or taking on, you know, responsibilities for the monastery. So we all have these challenges that are presented to us, or just, you know, just throughout the daily, throughout the year, just different challenges are presented. So I like this in the sense of like, so it starts off with sort of, you know, like, you know, if something is like, you know, not challenging to us at all, you know, just it's like something that's completely, you know, simple to do, don't have to think about it at all, and we don't have any skills in that area, the mindset he has there is apathy. So if there's no challenge and you don't have any skills there, then yeah, there's really kind of no interest. If you're not skilled in something, but then your challenges start to get, you get, you know, you get challenged, you're given a responsibility, then that can lead into worry, because, like, you know, you don't really, You have the responsibility, but you don't have the skills, so you're going to get worried about that. But if the challenge then becomes really great, you know, like it's this, you know, some significance to this, you know, it's going to cost the monastery money, or you're up on a side of a mountain and it's really steep and you got to get down, you don't have the skills to get down, then that's going to lead to anxiety. So that's the extreme there. But then if you have, the challenge is low, but say your skills are a little bit better, so you're sort of competent at something, maybe not an expert, but you're competent at something, but there's no challenge there, then that kind of leads to boredom. So you can look at your own life here in the monastery. Like a lot of times we do spend a lot of time, you know, alone. There can be a sense of boredom, and so most of us here are quite, you know, educated and competent in many things, but you know, if we don't challenge ourselves with things, we're not sort of looking at how to do, you know, memorize chanting or studying or taking on meditation subjects when we go out to the forest, or you know, challenging ourselves. If we don't have those challenges that, you know, are challenging ourselves, then that can lead to, say, boredom. But the challenges are low, but you're extremely skilled. He's got written down his thing, relaxation, which I would think of that as like, say, indifference or, you know, boredom leading into indifference. But as you increase sort of like the challenges are increased and your skills are increased, then the challenge is really high and your skills are developing, but they're not, you know, perfect. That leads into interest. So we're getting into sort of more positive sort of mind states here. So it's like, yeah, the challenge is there, but you don't quite have the skills exactly to do it. And that's where the mind can sort of, yeah, get intrigued by what it's doing, what it needs to do to get to that perfected level. And that's one of the areas that I kind of try to get into with meditation, is you know, learning that what are the interests. Then he goes to the other side. If you're like extremely skilled at something, but maybe the challenge isn't there. I'm not sure if I totally agree with this, but he has to get down control. So it's like you get into the controlling state of mind. So like you're really skilled at something, but there's not much challenge. So it's like, yeah, you can just control things and just do things the way you want to do them, and you don't really have to think about it too much, but you can be in charge. It's just one way I'm kind of thinking of it. But if you're extremely skilled but it's challenging, then you're going to need other people's input. You're going to need other people's help. The mind has to be a little more opened to actually figure out the problem, so it can let go of the controlling and has to rise to the challenge. So I think that's quite an interesting. So if you see in yourself that you're, you could tend to control things or want to always be in charge or something like that, to look at that as, well, it's probably because you are really skilled. You are really intelligent, but maybe the challenge needs to be to you know, look at how to, you know, include other people in the process, or to perfect that through, you know, just raising the bar a little bit. But then when the challenge is sort of, it's a good challenge for you intellectually, and you also have skills that you've developed, that's when you kind of get into that peak experience, the flow. Maybe that's even where sort of jhana will arise. Like you really have the skills to, you know, to sit long hours, and you do have the challenge of, you know, you do see that death is knocking on the door, and you do really want to find an answer to, you know, why do we suffer? How does this all come about? How do we create that? So you have the challenge and the skills, and you have the energy to apply that. That's when the mind can unify. So I'll leave that for our contemplation this evening.